Deer Valley's The Brass Tag Restaurant is pleased to support KPCW. The Brass Tag, located in the lodges at Deer Valley, is open nightly from 3 to 10 p.m. and serves a full dinner menu from 5:30 to 9 p.m., offering brick oven cuisine and a full bar. 649-1000 or deervalley.com.
Mark Miller Subaru is proud to sponsor the Sundance Reel on KPCW, an independent film at Park City Film Series. Mark Miller Subaru supports the community through our nonprofit partnerships and helps protect the environment with our green initiatives. Located on South State Street in Salt Lake City and Southtown in Sandy, offering a wide selection of new 2016 Subaru and pre-owned vehicles. Love the experience at markmillersubaru.com.
And welcome back to Sundance Weekend, our second hour here. I'm here with David Darcy, a critic from Screen Internet.
International, same as the last hour.
Screen International. Yes. We have a documentary in the festival this year called Holy Hell. And the director here, Will Allen, at least purportedly your name is Will Allen, is that right?
That is my given name, yes.
Yeah, that sounds like you're contestant on To Tell the Truth or something. And it is about a person's, your experience with a cult community. We'll kind of let you tell the story from this point, because there's certain things that you don't want to give away to an audience, or and certain things maybe, I don't know which things we can talk about at this point. But you start at square one tell us where this started.
Well, I mean, I was a filmmaker since I was young, and I went to film school in Texas. And right after film school, I was pretty much confused about what I wanted to do with my life, like I think you're supposed to be, but I didn't know you're supposed to be. So I had a big life ahead of me, and I wasn't sure how to be happy with it. And my sister introduced me to her meditation teacher at the time. It was 1985, and no cell phones, no internet. And I was very interested, and I loved it. We sat and meditated and talked about not being an ego, not being yourself, not being these things you think, and trying to find something deeper and much more beyond our confusion. And we had immediate results. And when you start having an experience that you can't deny, you start pretty much investing in it because it's something that's helpful. So the first few years were very, very transformative and opened me up to so many things in life and, you know, the universe and stuff like that. So that was my beginning. It was one of those things that it evolved very slowly without us being aware of it. And how that happened was our philosophy was being in the moment, like being awake and aware in the moment, every moment, here, now, right? And that's like eternal. So because every moment just keeps continuing, we were encouraged to remain around each other all the time and around the teacher all the time. And we created a little society around that, reminding each other to be in the moment, to be here. But what happens is there was no exit strategy. There was no graduation. There was no just do this for a couple of years, and then you can go. The teacher was very controlling. He got much more, you can't go out without, you can't go away from this and maintain this. You have to remain with us and with me. And we all pretty much agreed that that was kind of like true. We were in that group think where it became us and them, like the outside world could not understand us, what we were doing, and we no longer identified with the outside world. We create our own way of thinking, our own vocabulary, our own subculture, our own pop culture within our culture. I mean, we had a whole community of 100 people that kind of fulfilled the world for us, in a sense that if we thought we were escaping the world, like, oh, I don't want to deal with that, all those people were in the group. Okay, so we didn't escape anyone. We couldn't avoid anything. We had to deal with all of our personalities. So that's not something you can escape in a small community. It's something that it's controlled, and you all work together to go beyond those things. And so it's very supportive to get past any kind of problems you might have with yourself or other people, right?
Yeah. And we're talking about the title of this doc is Holy Hell. And if any of you listening grew up in Utah, you might think that that has something to do with the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints. Or you might think it has to do with Utah itself. But talk about the coercive role that sex played in this community.
Well, that's an interesting question, and it's a complicated question because sex was something that the teacher was teaching us to transcend, that sex was a lower energy, and for you to find those exalted states of enlightenment, you have to let that energy rise up to your crown, you know, the head. And so we were all trying to abstain and avoid sex, and that was his teachings for a long time. What was happening behind closed doors was pretty much that the teacher was, again, elevated himself to that status of do what I say, not what I do. You know, when you get to where he's at, you don't have to do that anymore. This is kind of what he told me. And you get to a point where that doesn't matter, and you can now be in those sexual places. So it was very confusing because he would only do that with a few people behind closed doors under very secret circumstances.
So it's you know, I have to say, with, you know, the Oscars coming up and Spotlight being one of the films nominated, it's sort of like what the Jesuit priest said when I was in Jesuit school, is sex is totally wrong unless it's sex with me.
Yes. Well, that's what it was. That was the message I got. Right. But nobody, I don't know what other messages people got because I wasn't in their skin in their private moments with him. This is why I made the film. When the whole thing ended and everything was so confusing and so many truths were coming out and so many lies were coming out, we all dealt with it in different ways. We all departed and we broke up our community, and we how I dealt with that was to kind of come to understand that this happened to a lot of different people in a lot of different ways. He worked with every person differently, and women were also abused, but not sexually. There's a lot of abuse that can happen in this kind of role play with a teacher, and there's a teacher and a student, which he used to say, I'm not a teacher and you're not a student. I'm a master and you're a disciple. It's even deeper relationship than a teacher because it's not knowledge he's giving you, it's experiential knowledge. So it's something you have to catch.
How did you identify yourselves? I mean, did you say we are a self-realization group, or we are a religion, or
no? We tried not to identify ourselves. That was part of our charm, is we didn't want to become an organized anything, and we thought we were just special, just a group of friends. We really never saw ourselves as a cult. But what creates a cult is having a leader that has complete power and control. So we slowly identified ourselves as, like you said, a group of people going for spiritual enlightenment. And we also named ourselves the Buddha Field, which is a name he borrowed from another group, which we didn't know about. But but we found out later that that was also borrowed. Yes, I apologize.
One thing I found distinctive about this cult is that the role that appearance played, the self-selected people, if we can call them that, were almost uniformly attractive. Mm-hmm. And there was a real emphasis on making oneself even more attractive,
yeah,
whether it was from, you know, diet, exercise, mm-hmm, or plastic surgery. And, you know, this is in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm. Started in Los Angeles.
Started in Los Angeles, right, where one isn't surprised by that kind of self-beautification.
Right, because it's Hollywood.
But it is. But the rhetoric is seeking to undermine superficiality.
Right.
So, you know, I guess if we were talking about the contradictions and hypocrisy of religious cults, that would, you know, lead us down a lot of familiar paths. But what distinct, you must have looked at people, you know, most people I know who've been in cults describe having looked at people in other cults and said, oh God,
I would
how
never
stupid, how can they fall for that?
Right, I know.
Did you say these sorts of things?
Well, we're in it?
Yeah.
Not at the beginning, no. At the beginning, you know, it was all very normal feeling. It just got extreme, more extreme and more extreme. Because the teacher, I think, had more free rein to be himself, his vanity and he came from another country, Venezuela, which is very focused on plastic surgery over there. But how he would turn it to us, it wasn't like, oh, you have to be beautiful or you have to look better. It was delivered like this. your outer experience should reflect your inner experience. So if you're experiencing God and you're experiencing all this love and beauty, your outer should express it. So he would have the girls put on makeup and put on eyeliner and make your hair blue. It just started off very small, like, wear prettier clothes. Why are you wearing black? You know, is that what you feel? You feel black inside? And they go, no, I'll wear flowers. And so he was always pushing people in that direction. I think that's where it started. And then it got extreme because he was an extreme personality.
And he was using more makeup than all of them combined.
Exactly. Yes, he was.
Okay. You know, we're having this conversation, everybody who's listening, to avoid giving a lot of this away, because this film tells its story, there are all sorts of jaw-dropping developments in it that we don't want to deprive you of the surprise of. But you, how much footage did you have of this? And how long did it take you to edit it?
Yeah, editing was hard. But over 20 years, I was shooting during that period of time. I was documenting our group, and I'd make documentaries just for our group, just for our 100 people. And I'd edit them, and I'd pretty much discard all my extra leftovers.
Well, that's too bad.
Yeah, well, I know, but it would have way too much footage, believe me. But so I was left with about 35 hours of cut footage and verite footage that I hadn't cut, and interview footage with him. And I had made a documentary with interviews of my friends in 1990 that no one saw. That so I've been documenting this for a long time, but again, we had to edit this in the last period of time down to 100 minutes from about 35 hours of cut footage. Yeah.
And how were you able to get away with this? If I were a cult leader, I think one of the things
you're not a cult leader?
Well, only in this room. But the last thing a cult leader would want is an eager beaver disciple with a video cam.
Well, you know, that was interesting, because that was a jaw-dropping moment for me, was to realize that he was letting me film all of this, but I found out later that he didn't trust me. And so he kept his enemies very close to him. And so if anyone wanted to leave the group, he would try to confiscate everything they had. Well, I realized later that I was probably the worst enemy he had and the last person he'd ever want to leave, because I knew everything. And so I think he kept me there way stronger. He had a much stronger hold on me and manipulated things to keep me there for much longer because of that. And I do truly believe that now.
Instead of capturing the Freedmen, it's the sound like capturing the Buddha kings or something.
It's funny that a friend of mine went to India after this and had met another, a real guru or Indian guru who's considered authentic. And he was talking about our guru, and he said, well, my guru wears false eyelashes and, you know, makeup. And the other guru in India goes, well, you know what they say, false eyelashes, false guru. And that was his comment. And it was like, yeah, you know, but no one taught us that. We didn't know that. And this all happened on our own. We created this in a weird way. It's like a social experiment. Years later, we look at it like, wow, this all happened so fast. And there was no one directing it except him.
Why? Explain the susceptibility of the people who were in this group.
I think the longer you commit to something that you put your time and energy into, it's really hard to pull yourself away from, especially if it's a strong belief. And then when you build a community of people you have all these deep emotional bonds with, they become your family, and they also become your family because you've isolated yourself from everyone else. And so they become your family. You're working with them. You have business. You're living with them. It's really hard to leave, because there's the teacher who's creating conflict that he's supposed to be, because he's supposed to be the teacher. So we all kind of accepted that conflict as if part of our growth. And then there's a community that's bonding together, having the same experience together. And that bond is really strong. And I think that's what I learned after finishing this film, that it wasn't so much about the teacher as much as it was about us, and a lot about that's what we get to take with us. That's what we get to keep.
That sounds like the observation of a person who's been through psychotherapy.
Yeah, but I gave it to myself. So I came to this realization on my own. That realization, I have other realizations I have tons of help with. But no, that one, I see that was the lasting thing. The other stuff is too ethereal.
But this goes back to my question. What can you identify about the susceptibility? I mean, what's going to happen is, okay, you take this film around, and people are going to be extremely interested in this thing, because it has... Part of the look from the earliest footage is a kind of gauzy television look from that time, with people who look like actors, who look, mm-hmm, very, very attractive, mm-hmm, people. What if you can generalize, what got these people to the point where they could be taken advantage of in such an extreme way?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what I was looking into when I interviewed everybody, and that's what I was trying to find out, because I figured we all had our own individual experience with that. And we did, and it's a hard one to answer for everybody. But I would like to say that I think we were all very trusting. There was a certain trust in everybody. We all had an idealistic part of our personality that wanted something we really believed was possible, that we heard in all of the 70s and the 60s, just because it was over, we really weren't happy with that, with the Reagan period, and we all wanted something much more rich and deep. And I think everyone individually was looking for either community that made them susceptible, like they had no community or family, or they were looking for something deeper beyond drugs, you know, not a drug, because people go into drugs or anything to try to find something beyond their ego, something that they can escape from themselves. And so one of the things he taught me, one of the things I heard the very first meeting was, like, drugs are used, is this a temporary thing? You can't depend on that. You have to find an organic way. The drugs are just tapping into something for you. You need to find that organically. And I'm like, okay, I want to find that organically. So that's what made me susceptible. And then if I have any part of my personality that's an addictive personality, if I have any part of myself that's codependent or insecure, well, all those things are going to be keep adding to my susceptibility. If someone's giving me value, if the teacher's offering me value or I'm not getting anywhere else, that's going to add to my susceptibility. I need him now. He is that source of information that I don't have. And he becomes value. And so I think all those things combined make people susceptible to bad relationships. I mean, look at this like a bad relationship, you know, or one that started off good and ended up bad. I mean, people stay in those relationships way too long.
Okay, you'd been shooting, right, that's for sure. You'd been shooting this for many, or compiling the footage for many, many years. When did this actually become Holy Hell? When did you start working on this as a featured doc, and who knew that you were working on it? Did anybody try to stop you?
No, no one tried to stop me because I didn't tell anybody except people I trusted who wanted me to make it. I was at Sundance in 2012, and I was coming here, and my partner had told me to come and just reintroduce yourself into the film world. You know, you've been in a cult for 20 years, and you're a filmmaker, and come out, and just come out of the cult, and just come out. And so I'm like, oh, God. So I came to Sundance, and wanting to see if I fit in, you know, wanting to see if this was a community of people that I could resonate with, because I'd been so gone for so long. And they were. And I just saw all these beautiful artists who were passionate about their work and doing important things and supporting each other.
Which year was this?
2012. Yeah. And that year, I'd done all the festival and I'd done everything, and I felt very connected to everyone. And I just felt very happy that it was not something outside of me. It wasn't like far away. It was like everyone's doing it. And so I saw some films that really moved me, and by the end of the festival, Tracy, my co-producer, who was in the group with me for 20 years, and she helped me produce all my movies in the group, she was talking to me, and she said, you know, they have a documentary funding foundation. You should just try to do something. And I was like, you're right. And we had 10 days. I left Sundance. I had 10 days to make my first trailer and my submission, and interviewed six of my friends and put a 10-minute trailer together about what happened, and I submitted my first, and that's when I decided to do it, because I got such a strong reaction.
Sundance, they might put this out, you know, come to Sundance and find yourself.
It's not that easy.
You know, it's a little suspicious. That,
it's not that quick.
Well, or come to Sundance and find yourself doing something else besides buying an Acura car that's on the corner.
Some of the descriptions of the foundation do sound, there is this kind of charismatic, overwhelming leader in Redford, and you meet in a secluded location in a canyon, and
I'll be meeting Robert soon, apparently.
Is there a how-to or a prescriptive element to what you wanted to achieve here? There are Will Allens who are now 20, 21 years old, who are as lost as anybody, who are all as we all are, susceptible to some kind of charisma and looking for guidance.
We should all be able to get help. We all have to teach. I mean, don't come here fully formed, right? We have to learn. And there's different institutions that are built on learning. The 4-year college system, I think, is great. I think a 4-year life system would be great, or a 1-year or something planned. I think that when I look at a 22-year-old or myself as 22, I don't think I could have told myself everything I know now then. I couldn't have said to myself, you don't need to do that. Don't do that. Or just do it here and get out there. I don't know. I can't. No one can really do that with their life to kind of rewrite it. But I also know I can't tell people to skip. You can't jump forward. You can't just skip your life. You have to live your life, and this is where you're going to get your experience. So choose carefully what you want to do, how you what you want to what you want to.
Okay, should these young Will Allens or we could use whatever name they decide
Wilma,
to call themselves.
Wilma, there's yeah, females
Wilma,
out there.
Wilma Allen, okay, Wilma. And the would-be Wilmas, yeah. That's even a bigger thing now, okay? Should these people be suspicious if they see the would-be guru?
Yes, they should.
Looking in the mirror 12 hours a day.
They don't see that, though. They don't see that.
You saw that.
I did, but that was only after I was around him for, you know, 84 years. Most people don't. All they get to see is the first impression that they give. See, I would drive him everywhere. I was his chauffeur. He would yell at me in the car on the way to a spiritual meeting, right? He would scream at me, you slam the door, don't drive so fast, slow down. I'm like, oh my God, I'd almost be in tears. And we'd walk into this meeting, and all these people had been meditating for, you know, 30 minutes waiting for him.
Did he yell at them?
No, God, no. He walks up there glowingly and says, namaste, and they all go, namaste. And I'm back there going, what an asshole, you know, because I hate him, because he's just yelling at me. So I mean, no one gets to see that. That's the stuff that you just kind of have to drop your mind, which is another famous phrase from our
okay,
life.
What if you see the as
I do want to answer your question.
Okay, but what if you see the false eyelash on his cheek?
you tend to accept things pretty quickly. You tend to come to terms with who people are pretty quickly and accept them. At least a lot of people I know did. But this is what I would say to young people or anyone, especially now. I think people are way more savvy about people being an autonomous truth person who's going to give you all the everything. Never always have a always be able to leave. Never commit. Always, it's your journey. You can always step out and walk away. That's what you need to know. He got us to commit. He got us to make promises and vows. Those are really hard if you're a loyal person to give up. You know, people have that happens in churches and people in all these cults and religions. They're all committed to some reason. They believe it's the right thing to do. Don't make any promises that you're going to be stuck with that you can't get out of. That was my main. That's my main thing, because I have people getting in it now. They're like, "What should I do?" I'm like, "Make sure you know where the back door is and get out."
That's what somebody said to me about buying real estate.
Well,
but I think
Might not be the best advice. I'm just saying, I don't want to tell people not to have their own journey, whatever that might be. But don't follow a teacher. I would just say, don't follow a single person. It's ridiculous.
There's a potential I see here for a feature remake.
Yeah,
there's so much personality.
Right.
There's so much these interviews. It's funny because we just came off an interview about James Foley, and there's moving testimony from the hostages who were there with him, and in a way, this is hostage testimony too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What you're showing, and amazingly revealing comments about what happened between these individuals mm-hmm. and the teacher.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that there's a lot that's left in this story to explore in a dramatic way.
Right. Do you have some idea what the effects of this will be? I presume the teacher is out there someplace,
yes,
and he's in a, you know,
he has ears in all of this.
Is
right
he
now.
In the green room?
I hope not. I'd love him to sit down and have an interview. It'd be awesome. But you know, he will never commit himself to something like that that he can't be in complete control of.
Okay, what's the status of this film? Is it for sale here? Are you looking for a distributor?
Yes, we are, actually. We came here looking for a distributor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the if they haven't seen it already, the first showing for Holy Hill is again, small irony alert, the Temple Har Shalom Theater on Monday at noon. Tuesday at the Sundance Resort. Remember, watch at those secluded locations in the canyon. Remember, watch out for those. And it gets back Wednesday at the Library Center Theater in Park City, and Thursday, Redstone Cinema, and some further showings at the Library Center Theater, and finally down at the Salt Lake City Library Theater. So, Will Allen, the director of Holy Hill, and the guy who lived it, thank you for being here.
Right. And if you're going to burn in hell, the first few years are better than what it ends up being.
Yeah. Exactly. Thank you guys so much.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Richard Bizzaro.
And I'm Rick Redford with All Resort Group, a proud sponsor of KPCW.
We take pride in over 45 years of service to our community. We are committed to safe, reliable, and comfortable travel for our guests.
Reservations available at allresort.com or at 649-3999.
We move people.
This is Craig McCarthy with the Park City Chamber Bureau. Being a member of the Chamber Bureau is a great investment for your business and provides a wide array of benefits. We promote your business, provide networking and educational opportunities, and even have benefit programs for you and your employees. For more information, visit us online at visitparkcity.com or call us at 649-6100. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit, membership-based organization and a proud supporter of KPCW.
Hi, this is Guy Raz, host of the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Join me for the TED Radio Hour Sunday mornings at 10 right here on KPCW. Each episode takes you on a journey through the world of ideas with riveting speakers from the renowned TED stage. The show is the fastest-growing program in public radio history, and it's on Sundays at 10 a.m. on 91.9 and 88.1 FM, KPCW.
Brought to you in part by Park City Film Studios and Crandall Capital.